19.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the May 25, 2022 reading of the Environment Program. I'm Karen Wheeler, and today we will be reading the following main articles. Journey into the World's First Underwater Farm. A team of Italian divers is growing basil, tomatoes, and strawberries. Written by Vittoria Traverso for the Environment Desk at atlasobscura.com. These bats buzz like hornets to scare off predators. Scientists say they've discovered the first case of mammals mimicking insects to defend themselves from being eaten. Written by Sam Jones for the Science section of the New York Times. Will the jaguar return to the American Southwest? Scientists monitoring the big cats in northwestern Mexico see potential paths to reintroduction across the border. Written by Ganesh Marin and John Koprowski for the Environment Desk at atlasobscura.com. And of course, if we have time, following up with miscellaneous articles. First up, Journey into the World's First Underwater Farm. A team of Italian divers is growing basil, tomatoes, and strawberries. By Vittoria Traverso. 5 years ago, Sergio Gamberini, a professional scuba diver and amateur gardener from Liguria, a coastal region in northwest Italy, was hanging out with local farmers. "I started wondering if crops could grow in the ocean," he says. "I had this vision about a vegetable garden inside a transparent balloon filled with air." His friends were skeptical, but Gamberini, a chemical engineer who runs a scuba diving equipment business, was determined to prove that his idea could work. 2 days later, he put on his diving gear and, 22 feet below sea level, attached a plastic balloon filled with a little pot of soil and basil seeds to the seabed. And after a few days, tiny basil leaves were sprouting. The following year, Gamberini, a self-declared, quote, explorer of all things ocean, devoted part of the budget of his family-owned business, Ocean Reef, to fund the first fully functional underwater farm. It was a matter of personal curiosity. "I want to find out if underwater farming can become a suitable alternative during my lifetime," he says. He also hopes that if underwater farming takes off, he'll be the one holding the patented technology. Today, his project, named Nemo's Garden, counts 6 underwater greenhouses hosting an estimated 700 plants, including basil, tomatoes, salad, strawberries, aloe vera, mint, marjoram, and licorice. The journey from what many saw as a, quote, odd experiment to full-scale underwater farm wasn't easy. According to Italian environmental laws, it is illegal to make any permanent changes to the sea floor. So, the first challenge was to create removable underwater greenhouses. "At first, we designed semispheres made of polyvinyl chloride, or PVC, a common thermoplastic material that was very light and could be easily removed," says Nemo's garden project manager, Gianni Fontanesi. "But after the first winter storm, when waves between 9 and 13 feet uprooted 2 of the underwater structures, the team opted for a different strategy. We now use rigid plexiglass with an internal and external steel skeleton," Fontanesi explains, adding that finding the right design to prevent storm damage has been the greatest challenge to date. The semispheres are 6 feet wide and 3 feet high, and are attached to the seafloor with 28 removable screws. According to Fontanesi, this design ensures stability while allowing enough oscillation to prevent wreckage when waves hit. Next, the team had to figure out the science of underwater farming. Most light is provided by natural sunlight. We get 70% of sunlight compared with surface levels, Fontanesi explains. During winter months or cloudy days, artificial light from LED lamps placed inside the spheres supplements the natural light. This electricity comes from solar panels and a small wind turbine on shore, which is fed to the greenhouses along with water for irrigation via a system of tubes shaped like a double helix. For now, the project requires fresh water from land, but as Gamberini explains, the long-term goal of NEMOS is to harness the natural desalination process that takes place in the greenhouses. This would take advantage of the fact that the greenhouses are not entirely sealed. The bottom has a breach used by divers to access the plants that lets ocean water in. This does not mean that the entire biosphere is flooded. Much like in a bottle submerged underwater, water fills only part of the structures. Air pressure keeps it at bay, leaving the upper part dry. When seawater comes in contact with the greenhouse's warm air, it evaporates, losing its salty component. This naturally desalinated water eventually condenses on the greenhouse walls into droplets that can be collected and, after adding minerals, used for irrigation. Gamberini and Fontanesi can monitor the temperature, air composition, and energy use from the project headquarters in Genoa, Liguria's main city. But farming is done by visiting the greenhouses in person. To date, Fontanesi has logged nearly 1,000 farming dives. He says it feels like being in an aquarium turned inside out. You are the fish looking out into the outside world. Some environmental activists have raised concerns about NEMOS garden disrupting the surrounding ocean ecosystem. But Fontanesi says that for now there is no evidence of negative impact. A few months ago, one of our divers found a large squid laying a nest beside one of the energy pipes, he says. So it seems that fish and other animals are finding a way to coexist with our farm. In order to promote the project, the team allows any certified diver to come and check the site. Many local people were initially skeptical about my bizarre idea, Gamberini says, but now people are realizing that it works, and it helps put Noli on the tourist map. September is probably the best time to visit. That's when NEMOS Harvest Feast takes place. We get together with family and friends and celebrate the end of summer with food cooked with underwater plants, Fontanesi explains. One of the gastronomic highlights is pesto, Liguria's iconic pasta sauce, which is prepared with underwater basil. Many people ask us if we can tell the difference from regular pesto, Fontanesi says. I am not a basil expert, but to me it tastes exactly the same. So far, the most surprising discovery regards underwater plant chemistry. Plants grown 22 feet below sea level face double the amount of atmospheric pressure compared with their counterparts on land. This, according to Fontanesi, has led to a different distribution of chemical elements. Basil plants grown underwater, for example, have higher concentrations of eugenol, a substance contained in basil essential oils, and more chlorophyll, the substance that allows for photosynthesis to take place, compared with plants grown on land. For plants that have a medicinal or cosmetic use, this could translate into heightened therapeutic effects, Fontanesi explains. He says that a French pharmaceutical company rented one of the greenhouses last year, he won't disclose which company, and turned it into a lab to prototype products made with underwater herbs. But the ultimate goal of the project remains to turn underwater farming into a viable option, especially in areas where water scarcity is an issue. Eventually, we want to create a system that is cost-efficient and energy-sufficient to offer a sustainable alternative to land farming, Fontanesi explains. That will take years, at a minimum. But if he succeeds, a wetsuit and scuba tank could become as standard for farmers as overalls and tractors. These bats buzz like hornets to scare off predators. Scientists say they have discovered the first case of mammals mimicking insects to defend themselves from being eaten. By Sam Jones. To scare off potential predators, some animals display the traits of more deadly creatures. A scarlet kingsnake, for example, wears a red, black, and yellow striped pattern similar to that of a venomous coral snake. Innocuous butterfly species display the same beautiful splashes of color on their wings as their noxious relatives, and nestlings of species of Amazonian bird are thought to avoid predation by exhibiting the movement and bright orange hue of a toxic caterpillar. These evolutionary adaptations are examples of Batesian mimicry, named after the 19th century British naturalist Henry Walter Bates, when harmless species evade predators by mimicking more dangerous species that their hungry foes know to avoid. Most instances of Batesian mimicry that have been discovered are visual. In comparison, there are few examples of mimicry with sound. Acoustic mimicry is very rarely documented in nature, said Leonardo Ancelotto, an ecologist at the University of Naples Federico II. Dr. Ancelotto and colleagues have discovered not only a new case of acoustic Batesian mimicry, but also the first documented between mammals and insects. In their work, published this previous Monday in the journal Current Biology, they report a species of bat that mimics the buzzing sound of stinging insects like hornets in order to deceive owls that might otherwise eat them. Bats are well known for using echolocation to maneuver through the air and locate their prey, but they also use various social calls to communicate with one another. We know that sound is very important for bats, said Gloriana Chaveri, a behavioral ecologist at the University of Costa Rica and an author of the study. Even knowing this, Dr. Chaveri was fascinated by the acoustic mimicry finding. This is something really new. They are using the sound to confuse, to deceive predators, she said. It was around 2 decades ago that the idea for this research first came about. Danilo Russo, a study co-author and now an ecologist at the University of Naples Federico II, was a graduate student working to create a database for all Italian bat species echolocation calls. When handling one species in the field, greater mouse-eared bats, he was struck by their intense buzzing, but he had to wait years until he was able to test the hypothesis that they did this to deter predators. To test if these buzzing bats do in fact mimic buzzing insects to evade predators, the researchers focused on hornets, bees, and two owl species common to the bat's geographic range. Wild owls, likely to have come across a stinging insect before, and owls raised in captivity, were both included in the study. The researchers collected data on how the owls behaved while audio of a variety of sounds were played over a speaker. The owls generally moved away from the speaker when they heard any buzzing and approached it in response to a non-buzzing bat's social call. But the response of the wild owls was far more pronounced than the response of owls raised in captivity, thus supporting the researchers' hypothesis that the greater mouse-eared bat adapted to evade predators by mimicking the sound of stinging insects that their predators knew to avoid. The researchers also discovered, after analysis of the audio, that the owls, because of their hearing range, would find the bats and hornets particularly similar sounding. David Fenning, an evolutionary biology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, who was not part of the study, is intrigued by the possibility of an adaptation that involves species that diverged from their last common ancestor hundreds of millions of years ago. Mimicry is just such a powerful idea, both in science and evolutionary biology in particular. It shows how you can get remarkable adaptations even among really distantly related groups, he said. Sean Mullen, an evolutionary biologist at Boston University, also not involved in the research, noted the potential limitations of the work, including the small number of owls used, and said he would be curious to see if, on a larger scale, the data supported the hypothesis. But he was enthusiastic to learn more. Anytime we can find examples where evolution may have led to adaptation, it's more evidence for how amazing life is, he said. Will the jaguar return to the American Southwest? Scientists monitoring the big cats in northwestern Mexico see potential paths to reintroduction across the border. By Ganesh Marin and John Kaprowski. Jaguars are the only species of big cat found in the Americas. They range as far south as Argentina and once roamed as far north as the Grand Canyon in the United States. Today, the northernmost breeding population is in the northwest Mexican state of Sonora, just south of the border with Arizona. In the Americas, the jaguar has long been an icon and symbol of power and connection to the spiritual world in mythology, philosophies, culture, and art. Jaguars are apex predators with diverse diets that include more than 85 different prey species, giving them a specific but prominent role in each ecosystem where they can be found. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature classifies jaguars as near threatened, with total population estimates ranging between 64,000 and 173,000. But evidence shows that local populations across the Americas are decreasing at alarming rates. Jaguars' total range has shrunk by more than half in the past 70 years, mainly because of hunting and habitat loss. Could jaguars return to the southwestern U.S.? Some experts think it's possible. Jaguars from southern populations in Mexico could recolonize their former territories in Arizona and New Mexico, or humans could reintroduce them there. We study biodiversity and wild conservation in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands and have documented jaguar movements close to the border. From our research, we know there are only two main corridors in the western borderlands that jaguars could use to get into the United States. Maintaining these corridors is crucial to connect fragmented habitats for jaguars and other mammals, such as black bears, pumas, ocelots, and Mexican wolves. Increasing connectivity, linking small patches of habitat into larger networks, is a key strategy for conserving large animals that range over wide areas and for maintaining functional ecological communities. The arid environment of the American Southwest has naturally limited jaguars' distribution in North America. Once these cats were top predators in the forested ecosystems of the United States Southwest, but predator control programs and hunting decimated population in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The last female jaguar in the U.S. was killed in Arizona in 1949. In 1996, an outdoor guide and a hunter photographed a male jaguar in the Peloncillo Mountains in southeastern Arizona. Since then, other jaguars have been identified, but no females or cubs have been reported. In contrast, jaguars are known to be present in the northeast corner of Sonora State in Mexico. Here, the Cajon Bonito stream, which flows from the west slope of the San Luis Mountain Range in the Continental Divide, supports jaguars and other large animals, including black bears, American beavers, and ocelots. For two decades, lands surrounding the stream have been under a restoration program run by Cuenca Los Ojos, a nonprofit that works to protect and restore land on both sides of the border. They now are part of a voluntary protected area program under Mexico's Natural Protected Areas system. To the east, the Llanos Biosphere Reserve includes habitat for jaguars. North and south, a combination of ranches dedicated to conservation and natural protected areas provides the habitat connectivity that jaguars need to move between Mexico and the United States. In 2021, we filmed a young jaguar, whom we called El Bonito, roaming in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. Each individual jaguar has a unique pattern of spots on its skin. When we acquired videos of both of the cat's flanks, we realized that we actually were seeing two jaguars in our study area. We dubbed the second jaguar Valerio. Lately, he has been spotted more frequently than El Bonito in the Cajon Bonito stream area. Male jaguars have to disperse as they become adults to find available territories and potential mates. Females tend to occupy areas near where they were born, a pattern common among mammals. The size of a female jaguar's territory depends on prey abundance and the availability of shelter. Jaguar males will travel across several female home ranges to increase their mating opportunities, so males' home ranges can measure from roughly 15 to 400 square miles. El Bonito and Valerio were juveniles when we first recorded them at our study site in January 2021. Since then, both cats have been using the stream as a corridor. Recent videos show Valerio cheek-rubbing a fallen tree, which suggests that he's establishing a territory in this borderlands area. At our study site, we've recorded both jaguars just 2 miles south of the U.S.-Mexico border. North of this site is Guadalupe Canyon, a natural corridor in the Peloncillo Mountains that runs into the U.S. at the border between Arizona and New Mexico. In our view, making it possible for jaguars to naturally recolonize suitable habitat in the U.S. is a unique opportunity to foster animal movement in the borderlands. Keeping these landscapes connected will benefit all species in this ecologically unique region that serves as a wildlife source and a pathway. Thank you for joining us for the May 25, 2022 reading of the Environment Program. I'm Karen Wheeler.